Chapter 2. Second Touch at the Teeth Show. Idler's Day, the 11th hour of the morning at the Shifting Revel. The sun was once again the baleful white of a diamond and a fire, burning an arc across the empty sky and pouring down heat that could be felt against the skin. Locke stood beneath the silk awning atop Don Salvara's pleasure barge, dressed in the clothes and mannerisms of Lucas Fairwhite, and stared out at the gathering revel. There was a troop of rope dancers perched atop a platform boat to his left, four of them standing in a diamond pattern about 15 feet apart. Great lengths of brightly coloured silk rope stretched amongst the dancers around their arms and chests and necks. It seemed that each dancer was working 4 or 5 strands simultaneously. These strands formed an ever-shifting cat's cradle between the dancers, and suspended in this web by clever hitches were all manner of small objects, swords, knives, overcoats, boots, glass statuettes, sparkling knick-knacks. All these objects were slowly but gradually moving in various directions as the dancers twirled arms and shifted hips, slipping old knots loose and forming newer, tighter ones with impossibly smooth gestures. It was a minor wonder on a busy river of wonders, not the least of which was Don and Doña Salvara's barge. While many nobles hauled trees to and from their orchards on the water, Locke's hosts were the first to go one step further. Their pleasure barge was a permanent floating orchard in miniature. Perhaps 50 paces long and 20 wide, it was a double-hulled wooden rectangle stuffed with soil to support a dozen oak and olive trees. Their trunks were a uniform night black, and their rustling cascades of leaves were unnatural emerald, bright as lacquer, an outward testimony to the subtle science of alchemical botany. Wide circular stairs, crisscrossed with patches of leafy shade, wound up several of these trees, leading to the Don's silk-topped observation box, comfortably perched within the branches to give the occupants an unobstructed forward view. On each side of this supremely ostentatious sliver of floating forest were 20 hard rowers, seated on outrigger-like structures that kept the top-heavy central portion of the yacht from plunging sideways. The box could easily hold 20. This morning it held only Locke and Jean, the Don and the Doña, and the ever-watchful Conte, currently tending a liquor cabinet so elaborate it might have been mistaken for an apothecary's lab. Locke returned his gaze to the rope dancers, feeling a strange kinship with them. They weren't the only ones with ample opportunity to screw up a delicate public act this morning.
"Master Fairwhite, your clothes!"
Doña Sofia Salvara shared the forward rail of the observation box with him, her hands scant inches from his.
"You would look so very fine in one of your Emberlane winters, but why must you suffer them in our summer? You shall sweat yourself as red as a rose. Might you not take something off?"
My lady, I assure you, most comfortable."
13 gods, she was actually flirting with him, and the little smile that crept on and off her husband's face told Locke that the Salvaras had planned this in advance. A little close feminine attention to fluster the awkward master merchant, perfectly staged and perfectly common. A game before the game, so to speak.
"I find that whatever discomfort these clothes bring me in your very interesting climate only serves to goad me into concentrating, keeps me alert, you see, a better man of business."
Jean, standing a few paces behind the two of them, bit his tongue. Throwing blondes at Locke Lamora was not unlike throwing lettuce at sharks, and the Doña Sofia was very blonde. One of those gorgeous Therin rarities with skin like burnt amber and hair the colour of almond butter. Her eyes were deep and steady, her curves artfully not concealed by a dark orange summer dress with a cream-white underskirt barely showing at the hem. Well, it was just the Salvara's luck to run up against a thief with the most peculiar damned taste in women. Jean could admire the Doña for them both. His limited role today, and his
injuries, would give him little else to do. Our master Fairwhite is made of unusually stern stuff, my dear. Don Lorenzo lounged in a far corner of the forward rail, dressed in loose white silks and an orange vest matching his wife's dress. His white neckerchief hung rakishly loose, and only the bottom clasp of his vest was fastened. Yesterday he took the beating of a lifetime. Today he wears enough wool for 5 men and dares the sun to do its worst. I must say I'm more and more pleased with myself that I've kept you out of Jacopo's grasp, Lucas. Locke acknowledged the smiling Don with a slight bow and an agreeably awkward smile of his own. Do at least have something to drink, Master Fairwhite. Doña Sofia's hand briefly settled over Locke's, long enough for him to feel the assorted calluses and chemical burns no manicure could conceal. She was a true alchemical botanist, then. This barge was her direct handiwork as well as her general design. A formidable talent, by implication a calculating woman. Lorenzo was obviously the more impulsive one, and if he was wise, he'd weigh his wife's opinion before agreeing to any of Lucas Fairwhite's proposals. Locke therefore favoured her with a shy smile and an awkward cough. Let her think she was getting to him. "A drink would be very pleasing," he said. "But, I fear that you shall have no reassurance for my condition, kind Doña Sofia. I have done much business in your city. I know how drinking is done here when men and women speak of business." "Mornings for sweat and nights for regret," Don Salvara said as he stepped from the rail and gestured to his servant. "Conte, I do believe Master Fairwhite has just requested nothing less than a ginger scald." Conte moved adroitly to fill this request, first selecting a tall crystal wine flute, into which he poured 2 fingers of purest Camori ginger oil, the colour of scorched cinnamon. To this he added a sizable splash of milky pear brandy, followed by a transparent heavy liquor called Argento, which was actually a cooking wine flavoured with radishes. When this cocktail was mixed, Conte wrapped a wet towel around the fingers of his left hand and reached for a covered brazier smouldering to the side of the liquor cabinet. He withdrew a slender metal rod, glowing orange-red at the tip, and plunged it into the cocktail. There was an audible hiss and a small puff of spicy steam. Once the rod was stanched, Conte stirred the drink briskly and precisely 3 times, then presented it to Locke on a thin silver plate. Locke had practiced this ritual many times over the years, but when the cold burn of the ginger scald hit his lips, limning every tiny crack with stinging heat and outlining every crevice between teeth and gums in exquisite pain, even before it went to work on tongue and throat, he was never able to fully hold back the memories of Shades Hill and of the thief-maker's admonishments, of a liquid fire that seemed to creep up his sinuses and burn behind his eyes until he wanted to tear them out. Expressing discomfort at his first sip of the drink was much easier than feigning interest in the Doña.
"Incomparable!"
He coughed, and then, with quick, jerky motions, he loosened his black neckcloths just the slightest bit. The Salvaras smirked charmingly together.
"I'm reminded again why I have such success selling gentler liquors to you people."
2. Once per month, there was no trading done in the shifting market. Every 4th Idler's Day, the merchants stayed clear of the great sheltered circle abutting the Angevine River. Instead, they drifted or anchored nearby while half the city came out to see the shifting revel. Camorre had never possessed a great stone or elderglass amphitheatre, and had fallen instead into the curious custom of rebuilding its spectator circle anew at each revel. Huge, multi-storied observation barges were towed out and anchored firmly against the stone breakwaters surrounding the shifting market, like floating slices cut from the heart of great stadiums. Each barge was operated by a rival family or merchant combine and decked in unique livery. They competed fiercely with one another to fill their seats, and intervessel brawls between the habitual customers of particularly beloved barges were not unknown. When properly aligned, these barges formed an arc about halfway around the circumference of the shifting market. A channel was left clear for boats entering and leaving the center of the calm water, and the rest of the periphery was reserved for the pleasure barges of the nobility. A good 100 or so could be counted on at any revel, and half again as many for major festivals such as this one. Less than 3 weeks remained until the midsummer mark and the day of changes. Even before the entertainments began, the shifting revel was its own spectacle. A great tide of rich and poor, floating and on foot, jostling for position in a traditional contest much loved for its lack of rules. The yellow jackets were always out in force, but more to prevent hard words and fisticuffs from escalating than to prevent disturbances altogether. The revel was a city-wide debauch, a rowdy public service the Duke was happy to underwrite from his treasury. There were few things like a good revel to pull the fangs from any unrest before it had time to fester. Feeling the fire of the approaching noon, despite the silk awning over their heads, Locke and his hosts compounded their situation by drinking ginger scalds as they stared out across the rippling heat haze at thousands of Komori packing the commoner barges. Conte had prepared identical drinks for his lord and lady, though with a touch less ginger oil, perhaps, which Graumann had served them, as Komori etiquette dictated in these situations. Locke's glass was half empty. The liquor was a ball of expanding warmth in his stomach and a vivid memory in his throat.
"Business," he said at last. "You have both been so kind to Grau and myself. I agreed to repay this kindness by revealing my business here in Camor. So let us speak of it, if that would please you."
"You have never had a more eager audience in your life, Master Fairwhite." The Don's hired rowers were bringing them into the shifting revel proper, and closing on dozens of more traditional pleasure barges, some of them crammed with dozens or hundreds of guests. The Don's eyes were alive with greedy curiosity.
"Tell on."
"The Kingdom of the Seven Marrows is coming apart at the seams."
Locke sighed. "This is no secret." The Don and the Donya nonchalantly sipped their drinks, saying nothing.
"The canton of Emberlane is peripheral to the major conflict, but the Graf von Emberlane and the Black Table are both working, in different directions, to place it in the way of substantial harm."
"The Black Table?" asked the Don.
"I beg pardon." Locke took the tiniest sip of his drink and let new fire trickle under his tongue. "The Black Table is what we call the Council of Emberlane's most powerful merchants. My masters of the House of Bel-Oster are among them. In every respect, save the military and the matter of taxes, they run the canton of Emberlane. And they are tired of the Graf, and tired of the trade guilds in the other six cantons of the Marrows, tired of limitations. Emberlane grows rich on new means of speculation and enterprise. The Black Table sees the old guilds as a weight around their neck."
"Curious," said the Donya, "that you say there and not our. Is this significant?"
"To a point." Another sip of the drink, a second of feigned nervousness. "The House of Bel-Oster agrees that the guilds have outlasted their usefulness, that the trade practices of centuries past should not be set in stone by guild law. We do not necessarily agree." He sipped the drink yet again and scratched the back of his head. "That the Graf von Emberlane should be deposed while he is out of the canton with most of his army, showing his flag on behalf of his cousins in Parley and Somne."
"Holy 12!
Don Salvara shook his head as though to clear it of what he'd just heard.
"They can't be serious. Your state is smaller than the Duchy of Camor, exposed to the sea on two sides. Impossible to defend."
"And yet the preparations are underway.
Emberlane's banks and merchant houses do 4 times the yearly business of the next richest canton in the Marrows. The Black Table fixates upon this. Gold should certainly be considered potential power. The Black Table errs by imagining it to be direct power in and of itself. He finished his drink in one long, deliberate draught. In 2 months, civil war will have broken out anyway. The succession is a mess. The Stradas and the Dvorims, the Razuls and the Strigs, they are all sharpening knives and parading men. Yet, as we speak, the merchants of Emberlane are moving to arrest the remaining nobility while the Graf is away, to claim the navy, to raise a levy of free citizens, to hire mercenaries. In short, they will now attempt to secede from the Marrows. It is unavoidable.
And what specifically does this have to do with you coming here?
The Donya's knuckles were white around her wine flute. She grasped the full significance of Fairwhite's story. A fight larger than anything seen in centuries. Civil war mixed with possible economic disaster.
It is the opinion of my masters, the House of Bel-Oster, that rats in the hold have little chance to take the wheel of a ship that is about to run aground. But those same rats may very easily abandon the ship.
3. In the center of the shifting revel, a great many tall iron cages had been sunk into the water. Some of these served to support wooden slats on which performers, victims, fighters, and attendants could stand. A few particularly heavy cages restrained dark shapes that circled ominously under the translucent gray water. Platform boats were rowed around at a steady clip, showing off rope dancers, knife throwers, acrobats, jugglers, strongmen, and other curiosities. The excited shouts of barkers with long brass speaking trumpets echoed flatly off the water. First up at any revel were the penance bouts, where petty offenders from the Palace of Patience could volunteer for mismatch combat in exchange for reduced sentences or slightly improved living conditions. At present, a hugely muscled Nicovezzo, punishing hand, one of the Duke's own household guard, was handing out the beatings. The soldier was armored in black leather, with a gleaming steel breastplate and a steel helmet crested with the freshly severed fin of a giant flying fish. Scales and spines scintillated as the soldier stepped back and forth under the bright sun, striking out seemingly at leisure with an iron-shod staff. The Nicovezzo stood on a platform that was small but rock-steady. A series of circular wooden flats surrounded him, separated by an arm's-length span of water. These wobbly, unstable platforms were occupied by about 2 dozen slender, grimy prisoners, each armed with a small wooden cudgel. A concerted rush might have overwhelmed their armored tormentor, but this lot seemed to lack the temperament for cooperation. Approaching the Nicovezzo singly or in little groups, they were being dropped one after another with skull-rattling blows. Little boats circled to fish out unconscious prisoners before they slipped under the water forever. The Duke, in his mercy, did not allow penance bouts to be deliberately lethal. Locke held his empty wine flute out for just a second. Conte plucked it out of his fingers with the grace of a swordsman disarming an opponent. When the Don's manservant stepped toward the liquor cabinet, Locke cleared his throat.
No need to refill that particular glass just yet, Conte. Too kind, too kind. But with your permission, my lord and Lady Salvara, I should like to offer a pair of gifts. One as a matter of simple hospitality, the other as a... well, you'll see. Grauman?
Locke snapped his fingers, and Jean nodded. The heavy-set man moved over to a wooden table just beside the liquor cabinet and picked up 2 heavy leather satchels, each of which had iron-reinforced corners and small iron locks sewn into their covers. Jean set these down where the Salvaras could easily see them, and then stepped back so Locke could unseal the satchels with a delicate key of carved ivory. From the first satchel, he withdrew a cask of pale aromatic wood,
perhaps 1 foot in height and half that in diameter, which he then held out for Don Salvara's examination. A plain black brand on the surface of the cask read, Brandvin Osterschalin 502. Don Lorenzo's breath hissed in between his teeth. Perhaps his nostrils even flared, though Locke kept the face of Lucas Fairwhite politely neutral.
12 gods, a 502! Lucas, if I seem to be teasing you for your refusal to part with your goods, please accept my deepest...
You needn't apologize, my lord. Locke held up a hand and mimicked the Don's gesture for shooing words down out of the air. For your bold intervention on my behalf, Don Salvara, and for your excellent hospitality this morning, fair Donia, please accept this minor ornament for your cellars.
Minor?
The Don took the cask and cradled it as though it were an infant not 5 minutes born.
I have a 506 and a pair of 504s. I don't know of anyone in Camorre that has a 502, except probably the Duke.
Well, said Locke, my masters have kept a few on hand ever since the word got out that it was a particularly good blend. We use them to break the ice in matters of grave business importance. In truth, that cask represented an investment of nearly 800 full crowns and a sea trip up the coast to Ashmere, where Locke and Jean had contrived to win it from an eccentric minor noble in a rigged card game. Most of the money had actually gone to evade or buy off the assassins the old man had later sent after his property. The 502 vintage had become almost too precious to drink.
What a grand gesture, Master Fairwhite.
Doña Sofia slipped a hand through the crook of her husband's elbow and gave him a possessive grin.
Lorenzo, love, you should try to rescue strangers from Emberlane more often. They're so charming.
Locke coughed and shuffled his feet. Hardly, my lady. Now, Don Salvara,
please do call me Lorenzo.
Don Lorenzo. What I have to show you next relates rather directly to my reason for coming here. From the second satchel he drew out a similar cask, but this one was marked only with a stylized A within a circle of vines. This, said Locke, is a sample drawn from last year's distillation, the 559. Don Salvara dropped the cask of 502. The Doña, with girlish agility, shot out her right foot to hook the cask in mid-air and let it down to the deck with a slight thump rather than a splintering crash. Unbalanced, she did manage to drop her ginger scald. The glass vanished over the side and was soon 20 feet under water. The Salvaras steadied one another, and the Don picked his cask of 502 back up, his hands shaking.
Lucas, he said, surely... Surely you must be kidding.